We'll call the subcommittee of the subcommittee of the Ways and Means Public Safety Committee to order. We're here today for the first in a series of presentations by the Oregon State Police in regard to their budget. Welcome back after 2 weeks of trying to balance the 0103 budget. I'm happy that state police are here because they were one of the beneficiaries of the 5548 in regard to the budget, and we were glad to see that many of their patrol officers and people from the crime lab were able to return. And Superintendent Rucker, I'm pleased to see you here today, as well as the rest of your staff.
Thank you.
Please proceed.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Ronald C. Ricker, Superintendent of the Department of State Police. I'm accompanied by my budget director, Major Danny Bisgard, and our BAM analyst, Bill McGee. Let me also echo the sentiments of the chair and our appreciation for the support of the Legislative Assembly and the governor in the passage of 5548, which brought back 85 of our laid-off personnel. I certainly do appreciate that. It's a very significant step in a the right direction. Let me also say that my presentation here is going to deviate a little bit from a type of scripted kind of process that I might otherwise use, because I believe that the situation here is atypical from that which we've seen in previous biennia. I'm going to talk today about a public safety crisis in our state that doesn't really lend itself as well to following the usual script. As you can see, Mr. Chair, I don't bring this message to you alone, as though my perspective on the condition of the state police is somehow only the perspective of an agency director who is presiding over the dismantling of an organization with an appropriately proud tradition. As part of my message today, I have asked and invited, with the chair's permission, a number of my public safety colleagues and executives to help deliver a message that certainly might be shocking to Oregonians. These individuals will be speaking briefly as part of my presentation, again, with the chair's permission, and I appreciate that. Over the next couple of weeks, you will be hearing from my staff. They will be described the many programs and responsibilities of our diverse public safety organization. If we were a highway patrol or a state bureau of investigation or an agency responsible only for crime laboratories, first, this presentation wouldn't take very long, but I would also submit that each of you, to you, that you would all agree that these separate funding responsibilities was rightfully the responsibility of the state of Oregon, and that each of our disciplines require both frontline expertise and competent leadership. The Oregon Legislature created the Department of State Police in 1931, and in 1993, the legislature added a number of standalone agencies to the department in an effort to re-engineer state government. At that time, the Law Enforcement Data System, State Fire Marshal, Emergency Management, the Criminal Justice Services Division, and the State Medical Examiner were all added to our department and have been part of the state police family for about the last 10 years. It does work. In some other states, we might be called a Department of Public Safety. In some places like Michigan and a number of eastern states, state police are structured just like we are. In the West, we are the exception. Washington, California, Arizona, and Nevada all have highway patrols. Idaho used to, but they're now moving more toward the Oregon model. They're doing this because it is efficient. Less administration, more frontline service. More communication at the administrative level, not less. This is what the public should expect from people who need to be working together to really do the job. Speaking of doing the job, please indulge me. I am a native Oregonian, born here in Salem, into a state police family. My father served the state police for 37 years, and I grew up with the constant knowledge that family plans were always subject to the ring of the telephone. Riots in Seaside and the Oregon State Penitentiary disrupted our family life, and as a young boy, I was old enough to understand that my father might not come home. He was aboard a light airplane that crashed into the Columbia River when I was in high school, and he narrowly escaped drowning. But as a kid, I didn't understand my dad was a cop. I thought he was a game warden. It wasn't until I was a little older that I understood they're all the same thing in the OSP. Detectives, patrol officers, sergeants, station commanders, and even the superintendent were all state troopers. For me, I started college with the idea of becoming a dentist. Working seasonal jobs with the department, I caught the bug and switched my career plans by the time I was 20. You'll have to take my word for it, but it is contagious work. The very job that most people wouldn't have for anything in the world is the same job that most people in the department wouldn't trade for anything in the world. And it's not just the officers, it's everybody in the organization, from receptionists in the field all the way to the people that work in my office. Why? That's an interesting question, especially if you haven't lived it. It's surely not for the pay. And there's more than enough heartache. To most people, the news of a police officer injured or killed in the line of duty is infrequent. They might stop for a moment and think about it and then go on about their lives. But for us, it's not like that at all. In my own career, 9 of my friends and OSP colleagues have given their lives in the line of service to the people of Oregon, not by disease or tragic accident, but in service to their fellow man. And 17 more people died for the people of Oregon the same way before I joined the department. In the current biennium, meaning 0103, more than $20 million has been cut from the state police budget, and this follows more than a decade of cuts since the passage of ballot Measure 5. Had it not been for a large number of retirements, we would have needed to lay off troopers a very long time ago. I've been criticized in this building for not hiring 75 officers in the 9901 biennium just because their positions were only funded for 6 months. People argued I should have gambled that the legislature would have found a way to keep them if only I'd brought them on board. That idea was certainly shattered with the passage of House Bill 5100 and the subsequent layoff of nearly 300 state police employees. We can certainly argue that number might have been 300 or 75 higher had we actually hired those people that we didn't hire. That's in the past. We're here right now facing the future and what's in store for us. And yes, we did lay off that large number of people that I just mentioned. And thankfully, we're now in a place where we've been able to bring a substantial number of those people back. But as we face the future, it's critical that you understand or that I convey the forward-carrying impacts of the choices made in Special Sessions 1 through 5. Capital outlay needs and infrastructure costs did not go away. They just got deferred. We have a staggering list of needs as we go into 0305 that will likely not be funded again. We mention this only as part of the realization that there is no more business as usual, as the governor has said. None of us are accustomed to having our integrity becoming a house of cards, but it has been a difficult situation, and we don't want to get used to it, but it is a reality that we've lived in the last number of years. Today, you are beginning to deliberate on the future of the state police. Please notice, as you hear presentations from my staff and others about the other funded portions of our budget in the coming weeks, you'll find that lottery security, tribal gaming enforcement, the fire marshal, and emergency management are all doing a little bit better than the rest of the department, and this is because some or all of their funds are not general funds. I ask you also to notice the direct inverse relationship between the stability of funding for certain parts of the department and the urgency or priority of those services. You might say the pyramid is upside down, with patrol, criminal investigations, a statewide SWAT team, and the Office of Public Safety and Security competing for scraps in the general fund. Each of these disciplines is critical, and each needs competent oversight. But the general fund has pitted these programs against each other to the ultimate compromise of the public safety and the agency's potential eventual collapse. My purpose here is to make a statement that's very stark and candid, because long after everybody in this room has gone on to the next chapter in their life, we all need to hope that there are still men and women who will stand in harm's way for the rest of us. Right now, I don't know how we can sometimes realistically expect that. We wonder who would take a job with the state police right now. Our sons or daughters? I'm not sure. And what would I say to the widows and families of our fallen officers? You know, right now I'm inclined to say that their loved one gave their life at a time when people understood the importance of the role of law enforcement in the protection of our quality of life, and thus the sacrifice was not wasted. It's getting difficult, more and more difficult, to say that as we continue to face the prospect of having people out there and possibly losing another trooper tomorrow. I would ask the committee at any time during these hearings, whether I'm present in the room or not, if there are questions, more information you need, we want to be responsive to you. And even though we might not be as quick to be able to respond as we might have been before all these infrastructure cuts, we are here to answer your questions. We want to do that, and we will. Before I ask my the folks that are here with me to come up and make a remark or two, I'd like to cover a few issues that I think would be of interest to the committee. Some have been discussed quite a little bit. One is our twin-engine aircraft, the King Airs, and the status of those assets. The first one was sold for $334,000. The legislature, the committee may remember that we had expected that asset to bring about $800,000 in revenue. That $800,000 is figured into our 0103 budget. The fact that the asset only brought $334,000 causes us a problem of almost $500,000 that we don't have a solution for just yet. The second King Air is in the process of being sold. That the revenues from the sale of that asset are also calculated into our budget at another $800,000. We'll see what the asset actually brings when it gets sold. But that we have begun the process to sell the second of those King Airs. Let me also mention to you the status of the State Police SWAT team. We have had lost a couple of people from that SWAT team to layoff in the downsizing of the department as a result of the Hospital 5100. We consider the SWAT team to be a safety net for not only our own people but other law enforcement agencies. We have made some reductions in training costs. There are no other SWAT teams that can do the state's work in this area as we try to provide that support to our own personnel across the state and various places in the state where that service just simply isn't available. I'd like also to speak to the question about the training of our recruit officers and our ongoing training needs for our personnel. There's been a lot of discussion about the DPSST facility, whether the state police will be in that facility or not in that facility. We currently have a longstanding lease with the Oregon Military Department at Camp Rialia, which is considerably less expensive for us and therefore the state than would be the new facility at DPSST. We remain open to the discussion and the dialogue about what the state police training programs are going to look like in the future. Right now, we conduct at our basic police academy a training course that takes 17 and a half weeks. But if that training course was done on a 40-hour-per-week basis, it would actually be closer to 22 weeks. So our people are getting a much longer academy, and they are getting a training that meets the mission of the department. And I hope that every police officer in the state of Oregon can achieve that level of training in the future. That's what the public needs, is to have well-trained police officers. And to date, and I know that is what's planned in for the future for the DPSST Academy, at such point as that is a reality, we certainly will be interested in continuing that dialogue. But our partners agree with us, whether they be people from the county level law enforcement, municipal law enforcement, ourselves and our federal partners. I don't think there's anybody that wants to see state police training degraded. So it's a conversation for the future, and one I certainly welcome having. I'd like also to talk about our command centers, or sometimes referred to as the RDCs. Over the years, we had as many as 26 dispatch points from throughout the state police. We went to a regional concept in an effort to get more troopers out on the road. Back in the late 80s, early 90s, we went initially to four. We went to and then subsequently we were able to go to three because of the advances in technology. And now we're down to two. We just opened the new 4C building here in Salem in partnership with the military, with an emergency management, ODOT, and a number of other partners. And we are operating for the entire state of Oregon. The dispatch and command center play responsibility from two locations. And technologically, someone can make the argument to go to one, but there would be no redundancy in the event of a flood or fire or something like that. So today, out of those command centers and coordination centers, they're not just a place where radio traffic comes and goes from, but they're places where our partners with emergency management, the state police, LEDS, ODOT, corrections, forestry, and the fire marshal are all supported out of these facilities. And both of these facilities, the one in Central Point and the one in Salem, our modern state-of-the-art coordination centers, and they represent the efficiency and the communication of emergency response operations that serve the people of the state very well. And if there was, I'll also say that there is an ongoing effort. The State Interoperability Executive Council, which was established under Governor Kitzhaber by executive order and is continuing on today, in which law enforcement, the fire service community, and lots of other stakeholders, emergency medical people, and other state-level partners are all talking about interoperable radio emergency communications and hopefully someday the establishment of a statewide backbone network on which every police officer, every firefighter, every ambulance worker can talk to each other in times of communication that will serve everybody's needs. Today, there is no statewide radio system that would support the mission of the Department of State Police except the one we now have. It's old. It needs to be updated. We need to do this not separately, but in partnership with the other stakeholders, because everybody's need is the same, and these systems, the technology is out there now to be able to build a system that is going to support everybody in public safety, and that's what we are committed to work toward. The day we have that there's a statewide network, it's not my interest that the state police still have RDCs or dispatch centers. That's not it. The thing is, the people have got to be able to talk to each other. That's the bottom line. In 9/11 in New York, they had messengers running down the streets with pieces of paper because the emergency services workers could not talk to each other on any of their radio networks. So we've got to do something in this state about interoperable public safety emergency communications. People across the country will tell you that, and have told me in my capacity as Homeland Security Advisor for the state, the universal concurrence across the country is that interoperable communications is the most important thing that we can do to improve public safety for the people of our community. So we are committed to that, and we will continue to work toward that goal. In the meantime, we've got to use the system we have, because there's no other alternative that will allow our people who don't work in a particular jurisdiction all the time. They get deployed here and there. And that's part of the mission of the state police, is to be responsive and go to communities when they call for help. And when they go, they've got to be able to talk. And the only radio they can talk on right now, statewide in the state of Oregon, is the system that we have today. So I will take a moment with the indulgence of the chair and ask a number of my colleagues to come and address the committee. They, in order, are Mr. Charles Matthews, the special agent in charge of the FBI in Portland. He will be first, followed by Chief Mark Adams, representing the Oregon he is the president of the Oregon Association of Chiefs of Police. Then Mr. Mark Croker, the chief of the city of Portland, and you can see the list. I think it's all before you. We'll go through that if you don't mind.
Thank you, Mr. Superintendent. You'll notice that the tenor and change of the presentation. I asked the superintendent to address some of the big issues that seem to be out there within the legislature up front, and I've asked every agency to address those issues that we can identify are kind of hot button, high profile issues that within the body itself. They are definitely not the largest budget driving issues, but they cause irritants in looking at the rest of the budget. The superintendent graciously address those issues, and I've asked every agency to try and go ahead and address those up front with the committee so that we can get on with the business of the committee as we move forward. Just for the edification of the committee, I met with all the department heads this last week and asked them to do that, as well as gave them some instructions that the committee gave to me in terms of questions that might be raised. Today we have Mr. Matthews, who is the SAC for the FBI, I believe.
Mr. Chair, if I may interject one more.
Yes.
After these gentlemen have testified, I also will be concluding my remarks addressing a number of budget notes and other technical matters, but we could go to Mr. Matthews. Thank you, Mr.
Thank
Chair.
You. Mr. Chair, welcome. Thank you, members of the committee. I am Charlie Matthews. I'm the agent in charge of the FBI at Oregon, and I appreciate the opportunity to meet with you this afternoon. The FBI's most important partner in Oregon has been and is the Oregon State Police. Both organizations, with statewide responsibilities, rely upon each other to leverage our impact and to meet our mission interests. From homicides to kidnappings to armed robberies to drug matters, The leadership and cooperation of the Oregon State Police have been critical not only to the FBI's success, but to public safety in Oregon. Their crime ops have provided important service to the FBI in time-sensitive investigations, primarily involving crimes on Indian reservations investigated by the FBI. But as important as their role has been in addressing traditional criminal activity, it is far more important now in counterterrorism and homeland security. The Oregon State Police is homeland security for Oregon, the place the FBI goes to promote coordination and communication of homeland security matters. And the requirements of effective state-level homeland security are becoming more complex and more substantial. From detection and deterrence to response and recovery, coordination and communication needs are significant. Their operational role in detection and deterrence is also critical. In each of our six joint terrorism working groups throughout Oregon, the Oregon State Police has troopers and commanders assigned, pre-cleared, pre-staged to join with the FBI and other county and local law enforcement to meet counterterrorism needs. In Portland, the Oregon State Police has a trooper assigned full-time to the Joint Terrorism Task Force. Indeed, this trooper, along with an FBI agent and a DEA agent, was co-case agent on the International Impact Counterterrorism Investigation, commonly referred to as the Portland Six. And all the OSP contributes to public safety in Oregon in a much broader role than typically observed. Their leadership and cooperation is important to the FBI's success, and any diminishment in their commitment could have a far-reaching negative impact. And that's my prepared comments. I'd be glad to answer any questions anybody would like to put to me. And
thank you, Charlie.
Representative Butler.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Just one question came to me, Mr. Matthews, in your presentation. at any time, can you, maybe the best way to phrase this is just one of the crime labs used by the Federal Bureau of Investigation versus when to use your own crime labs?
We have responsibility for investigating crimes on Indian reservations, and there are a number of those crimes that would have very time-sensitive evidence needs. Let's say an arrest is made immediately in an assault, a rape, a murder. There may be DNA evidence or other evidence that have to be processed in a hurry in order to meet requirements in court that we wouldn't have the time to send to the laboratory at Quantico, have it analyzed and sent back. So we're a user of the service to an extent that many of the state and local police agencies are.
Excellent. Thank you very much.
Senator George.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Matthews, I've had a few things that have worried me for a number of years. I mean, going back to chemical weapons that are stored out at Umatilla, along with a lot of other things. And my question is this: as I've looked at, for example, a responding state trooper with what equipment they have in the car, there isn't any. We talked about communication. I don't think there's anything more critical than every sworn officer in the state being able to talk to each other, but they can't. And my question is this: with what I believe we could be setting on some really prime targets, from dams to you name it, are there going to be additional federal dollars coming down here to help us coordinate some of these issues and equip our officers with the proper equipment?
The answer to that is yes, although I'm not the one writing the check. If I would, I'd write it today for you. I know part of the Homeland Security responsibility is to deal with the grants and the money that's being provided. I think it's almost $2 billion coming out this year to the states, not just another $2 billion coming out to the local agencies as well. But that would be a responsibility that would go through the superintendent's office to ensure that this state aggressively moves for their share of what is definitely necessary. There are venues here that do provide an attraction to people with terrorist interest. Part of the critical infrastructure in the state, which again is the Homeland Security responsibility here to help identify and to work with the managers of the security of those venues. So it's very appropriate that you ask those questions. Everything's changed. The way we have to interact and the skill level that's necessary is much different than it was 2 years ago.
Absolutely.
Excuse me, sorry about my voice, but I wrote down something here and I just wanted to make sure I understood you right. And what you said was state police is Homeland Security in Oregon.
At the state.
Yes.
At the state level, it is. And what the small role that the FBI plays, the federal role of basically detection and deterrence, we work in partnership with the state and other law enforcement agencies around the state. But obviously, Homeland Security is a much larger role, the response and recovery role, the coordination role, the communications role. When I get information in that needs to be disseminated statewide, this is the first person I call because that's where I go to move information throughout the state.
Senator Devlin.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Actually, just a very short question from Mr. Matthews. Just so the Federal Bureau of Investigation, how many sworn and unsworn personnel do you have in the state? And I know you have an office in Portland. I think you have at least one other location in the state.
We actually have, Senator, we have five resident agencies where we actually have office space in Eugene, Bend, Pendleton, Medford, and Salem, as well as headquarters in Portland. I have 110 agents throughout the state, most of them in Portland, and another 50, 65 support employees that support that.
Thank you. Mr. Matthews, I want to maybe highlight what Representative Butler's point was. Crime labs are a very, very important thing, and I've had the fortunate opportunity to have FBI criminalists testify in court on my behalf as a DA. I just want to ask you, as the SAC for the Portland area, you've had a lot of interaction with, and you've probably been around the country, you haven't been in Oregon the whole time, you've had interaction with our crime lab, and what's the FBI's feeling if we had a disparate crime labs and organizations doing their own thing as opposed to having one centralized crime lab with standards? Would that be something the FBI would even feel comfortable if they were to take a case federally that was processed?
Certainly be, I think, the wrong direction to go in. I believe that there are national standards, of course, that have to be met in the certifications that are required, even if you get your evidence processed to get it into court, as you're aware. And I have had the fortunate or unfortunate need to work closely with the state police crime lab people, all of them excellent, particularly in the Oregon City Girls case. It was state police crime lab investigators working with my evidence response team that did the crime scene out there. That's going to prove to be very critical in the prosecution of that case. I have the highest respect. It was disastrous when the crime lab situation developed, where the state police were closing those facilities. It's almost as if all the work is for naught if you don't have the crime labs to send it through and good, effective, well-trained people.
Thank you. Thank you for coming down. We certainly appreciate it. Chief Adams, welcome.
Good afternoon, Chair, Council. I'm Mark Adams. I'm the Chief of Police of the Kaiser Oregon Police Department and the President of the Oregon Association of Chiefs of Police. It's my pleasure to be here today to speak to you, and I want to start off by telling you how much the Oregon Association of Chiefs of Police appreciate the backfill that was done for the labs and the troopers for the current budget. And these declining resources, Oregon needs a functional criminal justice system, and it's made up of a bunch of parts. You know, I've been a police officer in this state for 23 years, and I've seen the state police just slowly be dismantled, and the criminal justice system pretty much being dismantled. Until now, I feel like we've put the welcome sign out for criminals. I mean, there's a lot of stuff you can do, and nothing's going to happen to you. And I think a lot of people forget is that the majority of the police departments in the state are three, four, five officers. They're little departments, and they're spread apart. You know, they can't call CSI out and have a case investigated for them. It's up to, you know, some police officer who's sitting out there in the rain with a dead body or what have you, waiting for the crime lab people. You know, they're waiting for an investigator because their department's not big enough to provide their own investigator. You know, this is where the state police, the unseen part, I think, of the state police really comes into play. Everybody sees the troopers on the highway. Well, they used to see the troopers on the highway. I recently, you can drive here to Coos Bay and not see any anymore. You know, people forget it takes, for every one of them that's out there, it takes 5.5 to put one out there 24/7. So, you know, when you see the state police dwindling the way it has, you can see it in a real hurry, there's nobody there. But in addition to the visible part, the uniform part, there's this other part that's absolutely critical to all of us in law enforcement, that's the crime lab. And the crime labs, it's just you have to be there to really appreciate how valuable these folks are. You know, they don't get the glory much because they're kind of like your IT people. You know, they're often seen as the geeks in the back, but they're the smart guys who know how to collect that forensic evidence. They're just invaluable. And when you don't have them, we're really out to lunch. You know, and it's like you've heard it said before. It's like sticking a wheel in the spokes. Everything comes to a halt. Big part of the OSP. The other part is when you're in this little three-man department in rural Oregon somewhere, and you're working the night shift, and you're out here by yourself, often the only other guy around is that state trooper that's out on the highway somewhere. And you guys learn to be partners. You learn to work together. And that's not there anymore. There's parts of the state now that don't have 24-hour protection. The sheriff's office has lost their people. Now the state police lost their people. And it doesn't take, you know, a rocket scientist to figure out this is a good place, you know, to either commit crimes, to smuggle something ashore. And I remember when I was a police officer in Coos Bay, one of the biggest dope busts in the history of the state was a state trooper looking out over the beach one night and wondering what in the world's going on down there. Okay? They're out there. I got to tell you, another thing why I'm up here is that I have never seen the level of cooperation between the local police, the sheriff, and the state police is what you have going on now. It's unprecedented. The superintendent and his staff have met with us and the sheriffs for the last couple of years. We've been getting together, and, I mean, if there was any turf battles out there, they're gone. It's how can we work together as partners, and we're there to work together as partners, but they need your support. They need staffing and funding to provide their mission, to be able to do their mission. And the OACP completely supports adequate funding for the state police. There's just, like the superintendent said earlier, you know, they're a Department of Public Safety. There's so many things that they have to take care of that 99% of the public isn't even aware that they're doing. And without it, we're lost. The biggest agency in the state can't do it by themselves. And the smallest agency darn sure can't do it by themselves. We need the troopers and we need the labs, and we need them very, very badly. With that, anybody has any questions of him?
Thank you, Chief Adams. Other questions for the chief?
Thank you.
Oh, Representative Butler. Just one comment that Chief Adams has made that gives me a little bit of concern, and I'm sure it'll be addressed as we get through the process of the OSP budget, is the all of the angst that there ever was amongst my 36 sheriffs has all been taken care of. I wish it was. And it, perhaps it is for Marion County, but we still have some of those small counties out there that, and I say small in terms of the number of people that you know, the sheriff is somebody they can pick up the telephone and get to in a hurry because they voted him, they elected him. I mean, they voted on him to take that job. So, I see some tremendous headway being made, Jack. So. I'm sure that Ron will address that issue.
Representative Butler, I appreciate what you're saying. Like any family, we don't always agree on everything. But I tell you what, we're working to get better today than in my 23 years. They were talking, you know, and planning together, and that's something that didn't used to always happen.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Oh, I don't know if this can be answered quickly, or maybe you can get back to me, or just consider it rhetorical. We've only got a limited amount of money, and probably the way the Ways and Means process usually works is that this committee will be able to spend so many millions of dollars on public safety. Clearly the troopers are important. Clearly the crime lab is vital to the way the whole system works. So if we're going to take money to restore that, where else in the criminal, in the public safety arena would you suggest that we cut to try and get the money? Is there something that you can say is less vital than those two?
Well, I think those are two very important pieces, but there's also other pieces of prosecution. Lord, I couldn't believe I'm testifying for indigent defense, but you know, that's another piece you got to have. You know, the Constitution says you got to have a speedy trial. You know, there's all these sort of things. I don't know the answer, and I tell you, I hate to be in your shoes trying to figure that one out because it's tough. I don't know if I knew the answer. I think I could probably go on the talk show circuit, get ready. But it's a tough time. But I think in the hierarchy of needs, until we can feel safe in our homes and our communities, it's tough to worry about anything else. So.
Thank you, Chief Adams.
Thank you,
Representative Butler. I understand before you go, Mark.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. I have two of my constituents here, Pages, today. I'd like them to just stand up if they would, Brianna Fresnel and Cassie Thistle. These young ladies are seniors in high school and homeschool high school in Vail in Ontario, Oregon. They're both 17 years of age. Very intelligent young ladies. Presented me with some language for a bill to some things that they saw that were of concern to them up at Bureau of Labor and Industries. And I think one of my senators on the other side is in the process of shooting it down right now. However, it doesn't deter them. They've come and are going to spend a few days with us. So thank you very much, young ladies, for standing up and being recognized. Excuse me.
Thanks. I think, Mark, are you up next? Nice to see you, Chief.
Good to see you. Mr. Chairman, it's a pleasure to be here and to meet the members of this committee and on this very vital topic. And you have been hearing in some discussion about rural areas. I bring to you a metropolitan perspective of the metropolitan city of Portland, where I'm the police chief. And to remind all of you that as I think of a state trooper, you know, we think of that trooper out on the highway. And yes, we do think of that person in those rural areas, but at a place where major highways come together and a confluence of traffic that comes across the Portland area, to me it has always been reassuring to know that outside of that area there are state troopers that are looking after that freeway and that highway and those people who move in our state. And specifically I think of those people who, with their flagrant traffic violations, they're driving under the influence of intoxicants, the other things that they do in the use of drugs and so forth, there's someone looking after them before they hit the city. And thinking of it that way, I look at the state police as an organization that is there as a partner, as is Superintendent Ricker, and he and I speak on the phone, cell phone, as we have crises that come up, and he'll call me and pull me out of the shower or what have you, you know, and I do that for him. I just did it recently when he was in Washington. So I think of it that way in terms of the traffic relatedness of the work of the trooper out on the highway. But also, of course, troopers have played a tremendous role in a wide variety of task forces with us. You heard the FBI agent in charge, Matthews, talk about the Joint Terrorism Task Force. But we've had others in our gang and gun interdiction efforts, in our auto theft enforcement. And when we have that enforcement having to do with guns, auto theft, the other things that are taking place in some of the most special, more sensitive and specialized investigations that take place, and a state trooper is there to be of help to us, really they're there in an effort that has tentacles throughout the state, because these things kind of come together in what becomes a metropolitan collecting point for criminal activity in the state. And so we deeply appreciate their efforts in that way and are very concerned, worried about any further retrenching of the strength, the rigor that has been in a very worthwhile and solid police agency that we all have learned to respect. And I personally, since in the years that I have been here, have grown to respect and admire very greatly. You've heard the discussion already, and with gratitude I add to those that are grateful about the crime lab and the restoration of some, if not all, of those cuts. I understand there are a few positions still in lab technicians and so forth that remain unfilled. We are concerned about that because every position, every lab technician in that crime lab plays a vital role in plugging that gap where we need that leverage for an investigator who works so hard and depends on that person for the court presentation of a good case, as you know, in prosecuting cases. But we depend on the state police. We need them. We need a strong state police related to metropolitan Portland and that part of the state. It is the citizens of the state who live there, the 550,000 or so who live and or work there. But in addition, now I give you a little perspective about what is happening. The criminal justice system in metropolitan Portland is melting down. It is imploding. And I have never, in 38 years of police work, I have never seen a more disastrous implosion of an entire system. And I'm not an alarmist, but when you see, for example, a district attorney's office that in 1999 had 99 prosecutors, and now with these budget cuts, 62, and you see the mental health system being defunded, places where we take our intoxicated people, we see, you heard about the courts, the indigent defense, and the fact that cases can't be put on unless they have that indigent defense. Courts going to the 4 days, the parole and probation, the custodial. And what we're doing is putting in the mind of the criminal element that's out there. I refer to them as the criminal army, you know, the group of people that are inclined to criminal activity. You put in the mind of that criminal that if I do this deed, I will not get apprehended. If I get apprehended, I may not get kept in jail. If I get in jail, I may not stay there. If I do, I may not be prosecuted. If I'm prosecuted, I may not be convicted. If convicted, it may not be harsh because they don't have room for me. And you go through a whole series of expectations that are reduced. And that's why every state trooper, every member of the law enforcement community and the criminal justice system in Oregon right now at this devastating time is really necessary. I hesitate to predict, and I'm not a prophet of doom, but I see out here in our summer a desperate time for our city in terms of dealing with crime the way we have been. We cannot arrest ourselves out of the picture, but a partner up there, Bernie Giusto, a sheriff of Multnomah County, has said it seems that the only thing that we have left is arrest. And arrest is not going to cut it. Arrest will be the temporary little Band-Aid, but it needs, in the safety of our people, as we look at what is really most important, and I don't have an answer to you for you either, Representative, if you're thinking of asking me that question, I'll just get to it really soon, as to where would you cut, you know, because I just do not have a clue. I know it's a difficult position that you're all in dealing with an increasingly big hole in terms of funding. But I just have to say that the baseline of American citizens and Oregonians must be to be safe and secure in their persons and their effects. We have to take care of that first of all before we take care of any other things. And I know that we're down to the margin, but I do want to add my voice of support for this agency. I have seen it whittled and have watched in serious concern. Now I'm very worried about an agency that we depend on so greatly for an organization that needs rigor. I'll close with one quick example. The reason I called Superintendent Ricker and reached him in Washington, D.C. was that on the 15th of this month, we face a possibility of a massive demonstration in Portland. It's against the war. People have a right to be heard. And we wish to protect that right and to prepare a situation that is safe for all involved. In order to do that, there's some information that is a possibility people go on the freeway. I asked Superintendent Ricker, would you and state troopers take care of the roadways part of this plan that we're putting together? he said this to me, we'll do what we can. We have fewer people, you know that, and our mobile response team has been cut back, and but we'll be there for you. And I said, thank you. We hung up the phone. But it's that kind of help where we desperately need to depend on resources when our own are out of gas. And that can easily be, when we consider the numbers of people that can be put on the streets now because of the sentiment that's in the air in our nation. And then you consider also, and I said to him, the possibility of the war when it actually begins, that the prediction has been massive demonstrations in the United States. Secondary plan then is to be prepared for that. And for that too, we depend on the mobile response team and the civil disorder linkage that the state police has with local agencies like ours. And so it is...
Can you basically explain... Some of the members of the committee don't know what the mobile response team
right.
is. If you could explain how it supplements... I'm aware of what it is, but can you explain
right,
to the
sure.
rest of the committee how it supplements what Portland is able to provide?
Yes. We call ours the rapid response team. There's a mobile response team. The concept is to have a group of people, police officers, who are trained together so that they can respond in crowd management in a disciplined approach in a way that is, with their training and with their equipping, ready for any kind of activity so that they're, for the most part, kept in reserve. But if there's criminal activity, they're brought to the fore and deployed in a way that makes things safe. They, in fact, it was the state police's mobile response team that did the training for our rapid response team as we stood up our team. But if you see people who are dressed, for example, with the extra gear, they sometimes look like football players, and they have the equipment that they wear and the extra less lethal munitions that they use for crowd dispersal, for example. We use those sparingly. We want to be careful in the way we do that. Because the vast majority of people are following the laws and they're law abiding, but when there are groups who would destroy property and damage people and injure people, then there's that team that is pre-trained and capable to rapidly respond and restore order very quickly. And the one that the state police has been deployed all over the state in a variety of places. For example, at the ocean when, was it Newport? Seaside, when there were large disturbances there, and they did a wonderful job. In fact, we sent our people to augment their team in that event. So that's the mobile response team, as the state police calls theirs. But anyway, I'm done now, and I appreciate your indulgence. I do want to make sure that you know that we in the Portland Police Bureau stand in support of the Oregon State Police and the funding for them.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll give you the reverse flip of the same question.
All right.
I've got a great deal of respect for you, Sheriff Gusty, and Attorney General or Attorney Trunk. Could your lip sync in Portland, your local government or Public Safety Advisory Committee, could that give us some guidance in terms of if we were going to make restorations, how would you prioritize the restorations that we'd be making? What are the most important things that we should add back and to what level? Because I share your concern that the system's melting down and it's not going to work much longer if it's working now. But in limited dollars, especially in the public safety system, where you add the money back, it needs to be, if we're able to do that at all, it needs to be in a coordinated fashion so that we're not just rebuilding one chunk of it without having the companion pieces fitting together. And I think that could be very helpful if we had a prioritization of what, you know, would the next $1 million be spent on getting the courts operating 5 days a week, or would it be spent on mental health, or where?
Right. And, of course, their perspective would be state, although we have county, city, state people there and so forth as a local public safety coordinating council, and we meet and we talk about issues that come up and so forth, and programs that each of us are starting that might have effect on the others in the system, and we hear about their budget cuts. But what you would probably want to know about is in the state funding related things that you would do, what would that council believe would be a priority arrangement? And so, I mean, I'll take that message back to them if you like, and we can put it on the agenda and discuss it. I'm sure, let's see, the county chair, Lisa Nato, I believe, a county commissioner, chairs that. And Mayor Katz is also in a kind of a co-chair capacity there. So they would be the ones to correspond. If there was correspondence, that would be the case. But I can certainly take the message back.
Thank you. Senator Devlin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm not going to let you off that so easily as Representative Hansen. I'm going to ask the question in a sense because I think Representative Hansen was talking about adding back, and that's probably adding back from a very reduced budget. But as I look at the general fund dollars available in the Public Safety Committee and looking at what the potential are in terms of what we're going to be required to come in at a certain level, an optimistic viewpoint might be that we probably have at least $100 million less than what the governor has in his general fund allocation for public safety. Yeah, I know. I'm being optimistic.
I'm a Boy Scout. I go with three.
And I'm having trouble actually even making the numbers come together. I mean, even figuring out a way that you could cut and make the numbers come together. And, you know, it starts to make me think that ideas that are far-fetched that I didn't think would have much public support, like Patridge's, the chair's revenue bill, which I wouldn't think would have much chance of support in this body before the day is over, may look like one of those logical solutions like we had during the special sessions, where something in special session one was, you can't propose this as a solution, and in special session four or five, it was the stroke of genius, you know, that this was being proposed at that time. And I just wanted to ask a general question because you're both two long-time professional law enforcement people, that one of the things I think is always important within an agency is morale. And I can't imagine what the morale is like in the state police at this time. And just to get some of your general comments about that, I should relate that I'm going on here a little long. I have a friend whose brother is one of the state troopers that's laid off. I don't know if he's going to be one of the ones that's hired back. But she was asking me the general question, if he's hired back, will he have a job long term? And I had to tell her quite honestly, I don't know. You know, and I don't think that that's a very good environment to be in terms of a law enforcement agency. And I just wanted to get, particularly the chief, because the superintendent's going to be here for a while, to get some comments on what the morale impacts are of this in a law enforcement agency, this uncertainty.
Well, you know, I can't imagine, because I have never really worked in an agency where I considered that my job may be on the line. I've always looked at morale as a police leader as something that I am responsible for in terms of generating the support to the people that are doing the work, equipping them the best I can, giving them a solid, good level of guidance as to what to expect out of me and what their job really entails, and recognizing good behavior and pointing out how much the people really do appreciate their work in the long run. They do really love their public safety employees and regard them despite the whispers and sometimes outcry to the contrary. But it's that recognition day after day and support that they need. But also, when it gets down to what you were saying about the who would have thought world in which we live, who would think that the morale level is now going to go to a point that your morale is affected by the fact that you may not have somebody to help you when you desperately need help out on the road. You cannot count on someone because there's no one there and you're alone now. And there's a morale level of depreciation and lack of support when you think that you're going to be out on that highway and help is not on the way. You're on your own. And that is something that starts creeping into an organization, and it strikes at the very fear level of an employee to do his or her job just to enforce the law. And you wonder, am I going to get the help that I need if this goes bad? And we don't want them pulling back and saying, no, I won't take this action. Or, as you heard Chief Adams talking about, I'm not going to check that on the beach. That looks like that could be dangerous. Well, we don't think our people will shirk from danger, but the fact is, it's a little bit dicey when you think that nobody's going to be there for you. And so that's the morale of a different kind that I don't usually talk about, because usually you can count on a budget that's going to sustain the necessary people to give help and comfort to you when you get in trouble. You know, we have put, let me say this very, very respectfully. I did not want to ever be viewed as somebody who was looking at Ron's people like a vulture, saying, well, we need some people, we'll scoop those guys up, you know, they need work. Rather, I would like to say we viewed ourselves as being available for a law enforcement career should they choose to do so, and we've made we've opened our doors to them. We have some applicants, a handful, not many. They're in the process, some of them. I think they're... Pardon me?
I said the training's already prepaid.
That's right. We haven't overlooked that. But they're good people, and we'd be pleased to have them.
Well, I'm glad my bill keeps looking prettier and prettier. You just keep drinking the water in this committee, Senator Devlin. Chief Cooper, I just had a real quick question. It's been run up the flagpole by many in this, well, not by many, but several people in this building over and over again that, Portland has, you know, similar services to some of the things the state police has, SWAT teams, crowd control units. We provide the state police is provisioned statewide. We don't charge local jurisdictions. They're set up that way, not only to protect their own people, but people throughout the state. And some people have suggested that, well, we should just let Portland do this. And I just wanted to ask for the record, does it make any sense for Portland to be able to provision that? Your department's really not set up to do that, in my estimation, to provide statewide SWAT assistance and crowd control assistance to the rest of the state without charging people or having it balanced within your own budget.
No, we have operated ourselves long before I arrived there on a purely reciprocal arrangement. Not billing each other, not getting into that budget line and so forth, and charging and back charging and all that, but recognizing when the crisis hits. So many times they're like waves of the sea, you know, get one here and then you have another one and then another one, and you're quickly depleted in a state of tactical units. For example, if you get a barricaded suspect in Eugene and the state team is off there, and now Washington County gets something and they're involved, and or for some reason theirs are in training and we send someone there, we're hanging out. And so, you know, we have so, and when we look at it that way on a kind of a statewide approach, we have so many teams for so many problems, and we can very quickly get saturated with incidents that occur where one team will come to help another and then you're out of people. So we need to keep this reciprocal arrangement, and to start billing or back charging and all that takes the willing assistance sort of spirit right out of it, I think.
Okay. Representative Hansen.
Can you remember times that the resource has been deleted because of multiple incidents?
Yes. Okay. Oh, by all means. We had one where it was a protracted situation in Portland, and we called upon I think it was Washington County in that case, and then they were involved in another one in Portland, and we had state police on the line to come. We had a period too when we had our unit was stood down for an investigation that we did having to do with an internal matter, and we depended on other agencies during that time. This happens.
Representative
Representative Butler.
Thank you. Just one question in that regard. Under what conditions would you send your Chief Kroger, your tactical unit into another jurisdiction? What are the criteria for that? I assume that you've got to be invited there. You don't just dispatch. I said in all seriousness because I do have one for Superintendent Rucker, the same question.
Usually that's done Chief Executive Officer to the other. There's a phone call in the middle of the night, hey, we need your guys. Here's what the situation is. Then there's an authorization right from the top and an involvement, whether it's 3 a.m. or afternoon, whatever it is, that there's there's a deliberate request and an evaluation of why, and then an authorization to deploy people. So it's involved at our level when that decision's made.
But it's your decision ultimately to send or not to send.
Yes, on invitation.
Right, thank you.
And then if, for example, there'd be another way too, where let's say we're following up on a narcotic investigation and there's a dynamic entry that's going to be made on some drug dealers with guns, and we're going to go there, and our detectives working out of the city are at risk, then we can use either our tactical team or ask for assistance from a tactical team for this high-risk entry. But it's always with good coordination and communication, if it works at all.
Thank you, Chief. Appreciate you coming down.
I believe that Mr. Harkleroad is next. Doug?
Hi. My name's Doug Harkleroad. I'm the district attorney in Lane County. I've been a prosecutor for 28 years. Never thought it'd be a lifetime occupation, but it looks that way. I want to tell you a story today. It's not a very long story. Happened back in 1986. In January of that year, there was a young man and a five-year-old boy. They were driving in rural Lane County, just outside the city limits near the Lane Community College, where an individual rear-ended them at about 55 miles an hour, drove them across two lanes of traffic out into a field through a deep ditch, and the young man got the car stopped just short of a huge oak tree. There was a quick response from an Oregon State Trooper there. There were it was a two-car accident. The person who'd rear-ended the young man was a woman up the side of a hill on the other side of the road. Trooper made quick assessments in both places, called for medic help. Sergeant showed up shortly thereafter. This happened to be, I know that sergeant's name, it was Captain Dixon, who's recently retired, who gave the officer some advice because the woman had been drinking, and so they did an appropriate DUI investigation. She was arrested, gave a urine sample, all because that trooper did what he was supposed to do with a good response from his sergeant. And lo and behold, there was a .14 blow, and there was marijuana in her urine. She was successfully prosecuted. The medical situation of the young man and the boy were a concussion for the young boy. He recovered. The young man had significant neck problems for quite a while. The importance of that story is that we had a trooper quickly there on the scene to make things happen. We had a sergeant, a supervisor, following up on it. It's an injury accident, automobile accident. You want somebody like that there. Then we had a crime lab who made things happen that needed to happen in order to make a prosecutable case. That's the kind of citizen that young man there that day, he really needed that help from those police officers. Now, the reason I know that story so well is that young man was me. And I'm a victim of a drunk driver, and I'm pleased to tell you that I'm pretty well recovered, although sometimes I think I can't twist my neck quite so far. So that's what we need. And I have watched since 1986 that deteriorate. Most recently, when we lost 60% of our crime lab, it was a disaster. I called on the morning when the levy, when the tax measure failed, I called the superintendent and said, we'll use some old drug money we have down here from forfeitures to hire back one of your lab people because we have to test drugs in Lane County. And I said, please, just assign somebody to deal with this. You've got other things to worry about, Ron. And the next day we had our package together. Now, I'm pleased that you folks put 40 of those people back to work. And so we're going to unwind that, and we're going to pay for the month or month and a half or whatever it was there that we didn't have that test. But we had that tester because of that. That's how important that crime lab was. The local folks stepped up and said, we're going to pay for that service. And I'm real happy that those 40 troopers are back out there, because there's going to be another young man out there someday who's going to get helped by those troopers. And by the way, the Eugene Police Department is hiring a number of those folks as well. It's not just Portland, but it's they're recruiting too.
Mr. Chair, that's an amazing story, considering that there may have been marijuana in Lane County. I just never
amazing. Yeah, and I'm pleased to report that I was not smoking it. Now, Senator Devlin asked a question here. Maybe it was Representative Hance about where would you get the money? I'll tell you where I would get the money, but I'm not in your shoes, and I probably would never get elected again. I would take it from the schools. And let me tell you, I know that's a terrible thing to say. Both of my children went to public school, and I'm a very strong supporter of public schools. My father was the president of a college in California. And his degree is in higher education. My daughter's getting a PhD in higher education at UCLA because the program at the University of Oregon is falling apart. I say all that, why would I get it from the schools? And I know that's politically unpopular, and I'm sure you have lots of school folks show up here. Let me tell you why. Because if those kids aren't safe, they can't go to school properly. It's really very simple. Now, where you get lost in there is what's the level of effort, right? How many troopers do you need? How many hundreds? And I'd suggest to you, at least from my viewpoint today, that we are too low on the public safety spectrum of funding in comparison to where we are on the school funding. Now, of course, that just takes you into a terrible nightmare, and I don't have to make those decisions, but I would get it there. Initially, although I would be back out there trying to fund schools with some kind of a dedicated fund. So that's a big bite to chew that I didn't need to chew, I suppose, but I just thought I'd tell you because that's what I would do.
People will accuse us of having smoked something then.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I understand the climate a little bit from being up here a number of times. But this, what the state police does for all of us is very important. There is one thing that I should mention that I haven't heard anybody else mention, and that's that occasionally you get a problem with the police department where you simply have to investigate the police officers, and somebody has to do that work. And over the last 18 years as district attorney, I've had occasion to pick up the phone and call either the superintendent or the deputy superintendent a few times and say, I really need you to do this because we need to investigate the Eugene Police Department in their use of force in this demonstration. I'm thinking of one in particular, but several different times. And they have responded. Can you imagine them giving us 10 detectives and 50,000 pages of reports today? I can't imagine that the resource there would be too large for their capability now. But it is an important function that they serve all around the state. When it gets really sticky in the local jurisdiction, you need the outsider to come in, do the shoot-em-up, and leave town. And that tends to be the state police, because they can draw from out of the local area and do that work for you. And I haven't heard that mentioned. Well, and you missed my great speech.
You missed his great speech.
That's okay.
I've known Doug for a long time, and I'm certainly done. Appreciate your candor, Doug. You're willing to make statements that other people at sometimes are not willing to make, and I appreciate your leadership on that. Law enforcement side. Doug's been,
if I can help you later, let me know.
Doug's been great and definitely an innovator in saving money and other things, and we're going to hear from him again. This won't be the last time this company gets to hear from him. Doug's got some interesting things that he can provide as a result of indigent defense and some other things that we're going to ask Doug to come in and talk to us about.
I'd be happy to do that.
So, see you. Any other questions for Mr. Harkerod? He's also a good skier. If we can keep him on his feet this season, it would be good.
Hey, I managed to ski yesterday by field that was so foggy. And I have a son. That was the kid that got the concussion, and he's now 21, and he clears 50 feet of air doing spins, and I watch. It's amazing.
Thanks, sir. Virgil, thank you for coming today.
Chairman Patridge, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to speak to you today. My name is John Reichel. I am Clatsop County Sheriff, and I appear before you today as President of the Oregon State Sheriff's Association. And on another note, I'm an Oregon Senior Sheriff, and I don't tell you that to impress you with my stagnation, but more so to let you know that I've been in this game for a while and have some background to be able to relate some incidences and involvements with the Oregon State Police. And as you know, and I've been asked this by many people in your shoes, is that there occasionally is some rivalry between the agencies, and I think that's healthy, as they're the ducks and we're the beavers, or however you'd like to put it. But the reality of it is, for a sheriff, well, regardless of what county they serve, we have to, even though you can look at us as an agency head for the sheriff's office, but our responsibility, both by constitution and by statute, and some counties a home rule charter, goes beyond that, as we're the chief executive law enforcement officer in our county for the purpose of law enforcement services. And so we have to look at what is best for our citizens, and we have to rely on a complement of services, not just those services that we field, but also the services done by the municipal police departments and the Oregon State Police. And on occasion, you know, it's a mix of services even with the federal agencies. There are some things, and every county varies, and you're well aware that some counties, like ours, we're fortunate to have a fairly good complement of deputies to patrol with. And there's other counties that just do not have the funds and have a greater reliance on answering of criminal calls and other incidents by the state police. In the past, and as you're probably well aware of, in the past there were studies done and there was discussions and white papers and a lot of discussion of duplication of services. And I've never felt that there has been a duplication of services. I think there's an overlapping of services, and I think that's a healthy environment to be in. You know, in our area, we depend on the state police and the uniform patrols to take care of the state highways. Regardless of how many you field out there, there are times where if there's an injury, accident, or fatality, that we are closer, we'll respond. If they have somebody available, they come take over the scene, and they reciprocate that service for us. So you have a benefit to the citizens and our guests when that kind of environment occurs. There are some things, though, that only the state police are able to provide for us. One of those, of course, you've already heard on, is the forensic labs. There is no other game in town. That is it for us. Whether you're a municipal officer, a trooper, a deputy sheriff, district attorney's investigator, district attorney, that's the only game in town. And it is not just that it stops the case of work that we have going on, but as you're well aware of, legislation has been passed over the last few years to take care of those DNA samplings and registries for violent offenders and sex offenders. And those alone have been responsible for clearing up many crimes throughout the state, with, just like fingerprint used to be the leading science, and that is now. And that's all something that we depend on the Oregon State Police for. Something that's not seen outside of law enforcement and the general public is the behind-scenes work that they're involved with the law enforcement data systems. That's our access to DMV records. That's our access to warrants for whatever agency is. It's a central clearinghouse for that. And it's our access to the federal system. And that is something that would shut down most agencies. You know, we have a requirement by the federal standards of verifying warrants in a very minimal time because you have somebody detained in the street and you're depriving of their liberties. That is something we're completely dependent on for the state police to operate. We also have this issue of the troopers on the highways, of course, that we expect a certain amount of service from them on the state highways. And if you're a tourist county like the coastal counties, like what I live in, and you know the influx we have in the summer, if we were to try to replace our services on the highways, we would be depriving our citizens of law enforcement services everywhere but those highways. Between the highways and the state parks, they eat up a lot of the manpower that their office is able to field. And in going a step further with that, there is this inability of local agencies, I don't care what agency you are, to field enough personnel to take care of all of your peaks. A good example for me will be the Seaside Spring Break coming up here very shortly. And even with the decimated manpower staffing that State Police has now, they are going to field us 15 people for an MRT team to handle the peaks of what has been in the past described as a riotous situation. And in fact, people have been charged with rioting in Seaside. That's not a whole lot of troopers compared to the past, because we've had as many as 70 in the past, and they were all needed. And, of course, by the citizens of the town of Seaside, they've been invited back year after year because they help us hold a line. But Seaside's not the only place like that. You know, I've known in the years past where you've had Joseph Days, I think, in Wallow County, where they've asked for additional troopers. With the hunting seasons, when they're variable, different discretionary hunts around, they have the ability not to only move troopers to an area to field a situation that can become dangerous and hostile to our citizens, but they're also able to target the needs with the state police game enforcement division, or if there's fisheries or something going on where they can move their people around. Local agencies don't have the ability to do that and field for that. And as a backdrop, we sometimes call upon each other, neighboring counties, to help us out. But it is not the service and it's not the safety net that the Oregon State Police provides. And that is something that we are become very dependent on. And I think if we look as a total law enforcement services statewide, not just our individual counties and cities that all of us represent, I think as a state, this is an important issue for us. You know, you could look at standards, and I've kind of tried to run these through a while back, but you could look at standards if you're trying to field what is an appropriate level of law enforcement. The Oregon State Police and Oregon Sheriffs have struggled with this for a long time because, obviously, in a small community, if the geographic location of all your calls, your boundaries are fairly close-knit, your travel time is negligible. When you're in eastern Oregon, you can imagine Malheur County Sheriff with 10,000 acres, and he's trying to serve the same kind of population, but he may have a 300-mile run in between. That's going to be a whole different manning requirement. And the balance of that, the balance we find in those services by having state police integrated with local law enforcement. I think that's important for us to try to maintain, and if we compare ourselves to other states by per capita, and not looking at the mileage issue, just per capita, I'm aware that if we compared ourselves to California, that we would have somewhere in the neighborhood of 790 uniformed troopers in our state that are doing traffic patrol. The CHP, California Highway Patrol, has no other service. That's all they provide. Now, these numbers do jump around a little bit, so you may see it as high as 812. That's the number I was given, but I just did the math on it a couple days ago, and that's what I come with. The standard used by the state of Washington, there'd be approximately 812 uniformed Oregon State Troopers on our highways. And I know we don't even field 300 today. So there is a deficit there, that, and that it's been a declining issue for years. I don't mean to just sit here and talk and be able to answer any questions you might have, but I'm very concerned about the direction and the funding level for the Oregon State Police, and would encourage, I know the times are difficult and it may not occur immediately, but I would do anything I could to encourage or try to persuade you to increase those numbers and refield some of their services. Thank you.
Thank you, Sheriff. Questions for the Sheriff?
Senator George.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. John, I hate to ask this question. It came up a few years ago. I believe it was in 99. And that was, at that time, we were told that there was some study that we could put three, for the same amount of money cost the state, three patrol in the county for what it costs for two state troopers. Has any more been done that way, or do you think the bulk of the county operations would even want to take it on if the money came with it? As far as patrol, no, I'm not talking about the rest of
Representative Patrick and Senator George, I am not sure what the numbers would reflect today. When you take those numbers cross-sectional, and I know Oregon State Sheriff's Association does an annual survey of salaries, but there are places in the state where the deputies may make as much or more than the troopers, and other places where they don't. That sounds sometimes to us enticing, you know, because it gives us maybe some stability in our departments to say, okay, well, we have this many people to field. But then we lose that ability of the state police to be able to gather up their people and respond to an area and provide a wing of enforcement that we would not otherwise be able to do. Granted, we might be able to do that if every sheriff's office had enough people, but we are not set up to go ahead and field our people in another area with communications. You know, I know interoperability is a big issue for the state on radio communications, but that doesn't exist now. Nor do you have the issue of dealing with their housing and their authority. And if you go into a municipality, there's some authority issues. You know, we have statewide authority, all peace officers in Oregon do. But there's some issues that have to, in each area, be worked out regarding enforcement of municipal laws, especially if they have something to do with prohibited areas where people can be cited to keep them from rioting or other issues. And the state police has always active components in those areas, so they're aware of those unique problems by their local station area commanders. And those area things are always worked out in advance. And if we just fielded people somewhere and had no connection to that area, that would be a difficult deal to be effective.
I think the other thing.
Yeah, okay. Quick. You use the term exclusive versus exclusive services, like the forensics unit. And then you also mentioned that there are some services that are overlapping but still very valuable. If we would have to make further cuts in this budget, do you recommend that we concentrate on the exclusive or on the overlapping or a mix of the two?
Chairman Patridge and Representative Hansen, this is an area that would be difficult for me to speak on a statewide basis. As I mentioned before, our area is fortunate. I have 22 deputies to cover my county with. For the size of my county, I think that's almost a luxury by some standards. In our area, we are dependent on the state police, on those highways and stuff, but we could never take over, if they were to pull out tomorrow, we could never take over all the traffic enforcement and all those issues. But we could probably answer most of the emergencies, but we could not supplant the need for a drug lab. I mean, not drug lab, for the forensic labs. But and since I do represent the sheriff statewide, there are counties in this area that have one or two deputies and could never say that value would work for them. So I think it has to be...
If I had one or two, it wouldn't really be overlapping. It would be kind of...
Well, see, the overlap does not mean, you know, it's not like if you... went and bought auto insurance and two companies are giving you a bid and you're buying both of them and you only need one coverage. I don't think any of us, you know, if there was a recent survey that showed Oregon fielding the fewest law enforcement per capita of any state in the nation. And so I don't think it's an overlap. What I meant is that we have overlapping authority, you know. There is nothing to prevent a deputy from... handling accidents on a state highway. There's nothing to prevent a trooper from going into rural neighborhoods and being able to do criminal investigation. And so for us, oftentimes, it's whoever's closest, and you not only expedite your service, but you answer more cases and more calls for service than you would otherwise be able to. And even then, even in our county, in the summer times, at peak times, there are calls that go unanswered, regardless of our complement of troopers and what the Oregon State Police used to have there. So overlap, I meant as far as being able to do the other person's work to some degree. Our deputies have the authority to investigate game violations. They don't have the expertise that the Oregon State Police has in that field, and so we would never be able to do the job as well, and it would be negligent then to try to say that we could take that part over without a lot of further training and commitment. So.
Senator George.
Mr. Chairman, this is a comment, and that is that those of us who fly airplanes know that you don't fly the airplane unless both of the electrical systems are working, and you don't fly the airplane unless both of the fuel systems are working, because there are certain things that you need a little redundancy in.
Thank you, Senator.
Thank you.
Thank you, Sheriff.
Thank you.
Welcome, Jim.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is Jim Botwinis. I'm the president of the Oregon State Police Officers Association. The superintendent asked me to come in and make a brief opening presentation for the Department of State Police budget, and I'm very happy that he did that, and I'm obviously sitting here to do just that. I have spoken with and worked with almost all of you at one time or another. It is very difficult to sit before you today and try and put a fresh face on problems that the Oregon State Police has suffered for nearly 20-plus years. You've heard some of the same things so many times that I am confident many of you have it memorized by now. Rather than focus on what you'll most likely hear over the next 2 weeks, I would like to put a little different spin on our concerns. The Oregon State Police is a very proud organization with employees who are truly committed to providing the best possible service to the citizens of Oregon and its visitors. Our employees are so dedicated at doing this that I believe we have unintentionally harmed ourselves in the process. Each successive legislative session brought less staffing to get the job done, yet we continued to provide 24-hour-a-day coverage in every community that we possibly could. We provided the best possible protection and service to the citizens and visitors of our great state at great expense to our employees' safety and morale. OSP has finally reached a point that 24-hour-a-day service can no longer be provided anywhere in the state. OSP has been forced to further reduce service in areas that were already hit by service staff and hour reductions. OSP will still not be able to meet the needs of our public safety partners with crime scene investigation and analysis, which in the end is a travesty to justice, to the citizens and visitors of our state, and more importantly, the victims of crime. We've had to abandon drug teams, child abuse teams, and major crime teams. Again, all this is a tragedy to the victims of crime. What does all this say about the livability of Oregon? It seems that we have sent a strong message across the country to come to Oregon if you want to commit and get away with a crime. During a period when our country faces some of its most contentious times, we have systematically dismantled the Oregon State Police and other elements of the criminal justice system. This simply should not be acceptable. The Oregon State Police budget has been under a huge amount of scrutiny over the last several legislative sessions. We believe that not only has the fat been trimmed, much of the muscle has been trimmed, and some of the bone marrow has been sucked out of the organization. We clearly understand that you and all the legislators have a monstrous job ahead of you. We understand that you will have to make some tough decisions. However, we can think of nothing more important than the safety of our citizens and the visitors that come to our state. If seniors cannot be safe, if our children cannot get to and from school safely, if we cannot feel safe in our home, if we cannot travel the highways of our state, and if our visitors cannot be safe, one of our biggest economic factors in Oregon, what do we have? It is time for public safety and the Oregon State Police to be funded at the priority level that the public deserves and the safety level of our employees deserve. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, we simply cannot continue to function in this manner. Our infrastructure has been stripped to the bone, and 286 of our employees were laid off, of which 85 were regained due to your legislative efforts. The people of Oregon deserve better, and we believe they expect better. We must remember that public safety is one of the most basic purposes upon which our state government was founded. We hope that you will support the OSP's efforts to perform its mission, which is stated as follows. The mission of the Oregon State Police is to develop, promote, and maintain protection of people, property, and natural resources of the state, and to enhance the safety and livability by serving and protecting its citizens and visitors through leadership, action, and coordination of Oregon's public safety resources. Thank you, and I'll be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you, Jim. Questions, Jim?
Appreciate you being here.
Thank you. Superintendent?
You want to go? No, let him go. Mr. Chair, just quickly like to cover a couple of other points and conclude my presentation. Jim just mentioned and read actually verbatim the mission statement of the department. I was going to cover that. I won't reiterate it. I would point out to the committee an organizational chart that's on the easel that sets out the structure of the Department of State Police and its various components. I'd also point out you have this in your binders and reference some performance measure information, which begins on page 10 of your books. Quickly cover, you're going to be hearing the detail of these performance measure issues in the Mike division directors and other staff that are going to be appearing before you over the next couple of weeks. So I'll not detail that unless someone has particular questions. I would add that we believe that these measures and their indicators meet with the approval of DAS in terms of their criteria. I would also draw your attention to some budget notes that begin on page 20 of the booklet, and I will also put into the record that we have complied with every one of the budget notes to the best of our ability since the last session. We do have a handout in particular to address a budget note which Representative Hansen was instrumental in having placed in there. And that is information. It's a two-pager. It looks like this. I think it's entitled Response to Budget Note SB 5538 2001 session, talking about our need to work with to review and confirm our core mission and highest operational priorities in light of current budget limitations. And very quickly, let me just draw your attention in that handout to some various efforts that we made both prior to the last session and following the placement of that budget note. You'll see in particular on the back of the first page and the subsequent page a listing of dates and times of meetings with various people, including the governor's office, including the governor's public safety policy and planning council, including with three meetings of something new that's been created in partnership. You heard both Chief Adams talking about it. I don't think Sheriff Reichel mentioned it, but in partnership with the OSSA, the Sheriff's Association, and the Oregon Association of Chiefs of Police, we have informally commenced a group called the Law Enforcement Leadership Forum. The dates and times of those meetings are detailed at the top of page 3 on this handout, or the top of the second page, I guess it is. And the purpose of the Law Enforcement Leadership Forum was to formalize discussions and or create a forum specifically to discuss the operational priorities and the core mission of the Department of State Police. And those discussions have been going on. As you heard these gentlemen talking about the spirit of cooperation and the level of communication and all of that information. And I won't go on and on, but there has been a tremendous amount of effort put in to, as we have spent the last 18 months or so, constantly trying to juggle a reduced and reducing level of capacity against or and with the needs and responsibilities that we have with our partners across the various diverse responsibilities of the Department of State Police. So we can be happy to answer any questions that the committee may have of me. And that would conclude my initial presentation, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Superintendent.
Doug? I will make my presentation brief and then turn it over to Bill to go through the governor's budget. Looking at the handout that I had with the agenda on the front, I want to quickly go through this. On the second page of that is just some breakdown of the general fund and total funds between the various budget units. I don't want to spend any time on that, but you'll notice when I get to some of the staffing issues, the general fund dependence on a few of the divisions drive a lot of the decisions. On the third page is the FTE by division. You can see that the patrol is the largest division, but there are some other very key components throughout that organization. At this time, just to make sure you understand, there's some other sort of, as the superintendent mentioned, some other key functions of state government that really haven't come out in the discussion so far: the fire marshal, the Office of Emergency Management, and the LEDs, and some of the other sort of identification services that the state police, firearms checks, criminal records checks, fingerprint checks, all those things are also part of this agency, are very key to the mission of the public safety system in the state. Going to my memo to you, first on the first page and the top of the second, list of budget notes. The superintendent did mention one key in terms of their core mission examination. The first budget note there on page one talks about what the last subcommittee and Ways and Means Committee did last session was set expectations of what the criminal investigation, patrol, and fish and wildlife trooper strength would be. And unfortunately, they have not been able to meet that, primarily because of budget cuts throughout the biennium. And you'll notice their patrol is almost 160 under what the expectation was at the end of February. Criminal is about 27 below, and fish and wildlife are actually a little above, primarily because they have other funding sources other than general fund. The other budget notes are listed there. I don't want to really go through those that much. The next section is the e-board actions.
Again, I'm not going to go through that, but they did prepare a business plan and reported it to the E-Board, which was key to some of the decisions later on in the biennium around the budget cuts. Third page were the audits that are listed. Nothing serious here except that when you get to the 911 portion of the Office of Emergency Management, there are some issues that about the use of those funds that I think you'll need to explore that came up as a result of those audits. Budget drivers are listed there. Not going to go through there because there are many more than that, but I do want to quickly go through the issues I've listed here to make sure as you go through this budget that you keep these in the back of your mind as you go through it. The first one is, what is the highest primary role for the state police? Given the other actors in the public safety system, there's been some discussion with the visitors here about that today. You do have scarce resources. I know that we heard various numbers of what would have to be cut to meet the current revenues. You're going to have some very difficult decisions, as you well know. The agency has gone through a major reorganization. And I think as you go through the discussion that the agency presents, you need to keep that in mind, whether that was the proper place to move things around. I don't necessarily have any disagreements with it, but there were some major reorganizational issues, and the command structure in the department has changed. Number three on the top of page four, major staff reductions in some key areas. So if you turn to the long page that was part of that packet, the legal size, this is something you may have seen already, but I did put it together. If you look with the reorganization, it sort of made counting numbers and staff a little difficult because things were moving around. The governor's budget is based on a different base than the previous or this current planning's budget. But if you take a look at the sort of the third line of numbers there, the net legislative adopted budget at the end of session, after you took into account the reorganization, you have sort of a starting point for the total number of positions, and then the governor's budget is at the bottom of the first box. And you then the next line is a percentage decreases in the number of positions. And you'll go across there. Patrol was down just over 25%. Fish and Wildlife was down about 10%. They did lose general fund positions that are part of that division. One of the key areas is commercial fisheries. There were three or four positions dedicated to that function, and those positions are gone now, which is a key issue on the coast. Criminal division is down just under 10%, but that number masks more reductions in that area because of the reorgs. Some key security for the Capitol and the mall. Legislative security was transferred to that division. Those positions did not meet sort of the same cuts as some of the other areas, and also there were increased positions because of federal funds in that division. If you took that out and you looked at the core criminal investigation functions, you would have seen closer to a 20% decrease in that division. Gaming saw no decreases. Again, that's lottery funded. And so there were no decreases there. Forensics, the other key area, probably the hardest hit, saw a 62% decrease in the number of positions, and that was before you add the 35 back. But keep in mind, the 40 troopers that were just added back last week are funded in the governor's budget. Only five of the forensic positions that were added back are funded in the governor's budget. The roll-up cost for those 35 positions that aren't funded is $4.5 million. Medical examiners, no cuts. The Office of Information Management and Lead saw a 41% decrease. I'll come back to that in a minute. Human resources and training. Human resources is a large area. Does not only include training, includes the support functions of the department, but also includes the command structure of the department and a lot of the field structure that aren't sworn officers and also the leadership of those regional offices. The captains and head of the regions are part of this budget. Criminal Justice Services Division is purely a federal grant administration and technical assistance, federally funded, no cuts. Fire marshal saw 11% cuts in the positions between what was at the end of last session and what's in the governor's budget, primarily because of reductions in the fire insurance premium tax, and office emergency management saw about a 6% decrease. Again, general fund issues there. So you can see across the board, those divisions that were primarily general fund took some very major cuts. The number of the troopers is less. There's another handout in that same, another graph behind that. If you take a look at this, this is actually the number of staff or positions or sworn officers in the patrol division, that one of those primary functions. That now is down. In the early 80s, at the beginning of the 1980s, you had 665 folks or sworn officers. We're down to about 50% of that level in the governor's budget right now, 329. Raises a whole host of issues, some of which are already mentioned. Includes loss of 24-hour coverage of troopers over almost the entire state, expanded patrol area, slower response times, and possible compromise officer safety issues. The whole issue around staffing raises a number of issues about the distribution of staff across the state. You really need patrol. You've heard some of that, but I also want to take a look at the. I would want you to look at the criminal investigation areas. In many areas of the state, outside of the valley and the larger town, cities and towns across the state police are primary investigative staffing for small sheriff departments and small police departments. They are the major specialized resource out there for investigations. That raises an issue whether or not you need to take a look at that, if the current distribution of that staff, as reduced as it is the right distribution of that staff. Whether the Portland area, which has larger police departments, needs the level they have served now by the state police in that area compared to maybe Eastern Oregon or the coast or wherever that might be. Also, keep in mind, and with the distribution of correctional institutions, the state police are the primary investigative law enforcement agency inside the prisons. So, take Snake River, 3,000 inmates there. There are state police that spend a lot of time in that prison. And on the other parts of the I-84 corridor there on the east side of the states, investigating crimes within the prisons. Tobacco Tax Compliance Task Force, the state police are one of the key agencies there. In the governor's budget, the budget rebalance bill you passed last week had 5 positions restored, but they're not in the governor's budget. The Department of Justice is funded in the governor's budget, and Department of Revenue is funded in the governor's budget, but not the state police, and the roll-up there is just shy of $800,000 for those 5 positions. I think enough has been said about the crime lab. Don't need to speak any more to that. This budget assumes moving to a new crime lab facility in the Portland area. That building is already purchased. It's built into the budget in terms of the debt service and rent. You'll be taking a look at the COP for equipment, and one of the issues that I would suggest you take a look at is whether or not the reduced staffing, the forensics labs, whatever level that gets to, whether you'll need all the equipment in that. I don't know the answer to that, but it will be one of the questions I'll be asking the agency. Fish and Wildlife hasn't seen the cuts as other agencies, but if you take a look at history, in the past, in terms of the fish and game license fees, state police used to get 30%, almost 30% of that revenue. It's down to 17% now. It has been backfilled, or other funding sources like lottery funds have come in for salmon enforcement, the salmon restoration. But that also means that that division has seen their mission broaden to take care of that area instead of the general fish and game wildlife enforcement. So that's an issue that you may want to take a look at. Training resources, I think someone mentioned that already, has been sharply reduced. It's down from 17 positions, I believe now 6 positions department-wide in the governor's budget. Very little money left for training for to keep up with the science of law enforcement and the technology changes in in the law enforcement area. We mentioned about the planes. The money is assumed to be for this biennium. They could have a funding problem this biennium around the sale of the planes because the budget assumes a much greater amount than they have. Infrastructure, there are a lot of sworn officers reduced, a lot of forensics lab folks reduced, but a lot of the key support functions of the department have also been reduced, whether it's personnel, financial services, or training, and I think you'll need to ask the question of the agency for as large as it is, as complex as it is, whether or not they have the sufficient staff to keep the accountability that's necessary to run an agency this large. Capital outlay, I think the superintendent mentioned the drastic cuts there. There was, during this biennium, the legislature, through all the special sessions, has cut about $2.5 million of capital outlay in the information systems, ledge, and communications area. In the governor's budget, there's only $40,000 in there. A serious issue when you move to the next point, which has been brought up, number 15, the interoperability of communications, the inability for law enforcement agencies to communicate. One other issue there that I didn't put down in the paper here, but many local governments are moving forward with new radio systems without necessarily taking into account this interoperability issue, and it's something that I think the legislature really needs to take a look at in terms of statewide policy in this area. There may be federal funds available for planning, and we'll continue to look for those. Number 17, the Office of Emergency Management was elevated through executive order to the level of State Department. If that is to be made permanent, there will have to be a change in statute. I'm not sure where that one is. We'll need to check with Bill or the governor's office of where this current governor is on that issue. 911, the last legislature, 2001 legislature, spent considerable time talking about the 911 system, the funding for it, and the consolidation. As part of this budget presentation or later, there will be a report on the consolidation of the plans for each county were to come up with a plan to move toward one point in terms of having one PSAP. I have trouble with pronunciations because of a condition I've just come down with, and I apologize if people are having trouble hearing me or understanding me. But currently 14 of the 36 counties have multiple systems, and they will be reporting on the consolidation plans around that. And finally, two major sources of funding for the agency have been falling, other than the general fund, the fire insurance premium tax, which funds a large portion of the fire marshal as well as arson investigations. There are at least two proposals out there legislatively to backfill. And then the criminal fines and assessments, which you've already had a presentation on by Bill. But in terms of state police, it's used to fund training. And, of course, this has been significantly cut in this budget. Thank you.
Thank you. Bill, I think we're going to start you the next time we convene. Any particular questions of Doug at this point in time?
Representative Butler? And it's one that Doug can get back with us on, if he would, please. I noticed that between 1981 and basically where we're headed right now, over a period of 20-plus years, we've experienced about a 50% decrease in the number of OSP positions. I'd like to know what that is in terms of real dollars and CPI-adjusted dollars, if I could. And then I'd like to have further explanation as to why the King Air sales proceeds versus our expectation on those sales, where we went wrong in the expectation. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Other questions for Doug or State Police? Representative Hansen.
Well, just a general question. We're looking at a budget that's very similar. The governor's proposed budget is very similar to 9901 in terms of dollar amount.
Yeah.
167 general fund versus 166. Yet we've got, over 25% reduction in personnel. Now, Is there any other reason for that other than just the basic inflation that's occurred kind of across the board over virtually a six-year period, the six-year period we're budgeting for?
The Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, the majority is personnel cost increases, whether it's PERS, other compensation issues, it's mainly that area. I can't think of any large general fund expansion in staff or anything. It's mainly just the automatic increases that are built in. Yeah.
Okay. Gentlemen, we appreciate it. Just for the edification of the committee as well as state police, I'm unsure whether we are going to have a committee meeting or not tomorrow. We will be calling your offices to let you know. Representative Butler and I have been asked to sit as part of a meeting, at least on the House side, amongst the House leadership. So, discussing various issues. So, we will contact your offices. Let me leave it this way: that I will. We will contact your offices if we are having a meeting tomorrow. I assume that there won't be. I mean, I assume that we won't have committee. We will start up on Wednesday. I believe with the patrol division.
Actually, we'll start with Bill.
We'll start with Bill, and, yeah. And then we'll start immediately into the patrol division thereafter. So that's kind of the schedule for where we're going to be on Wednesday or tomorrow, possibly, but I don't think so. All right?
Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
If we don't hear from you by session tomorrow morning, should we assume
that? I assume that we're going to make a I'm going to walk up to the leadership offices to figure out whether we are going to have the meeting, and I will let Doug know. And but just assume that it is canceled for tomorrow, unless you otherwise hear.
When we expressed concern about the communications in the building, they said, "What, the carrier pigeons aren't running anymore?"
We're having our own interoperability problems. All right,
thank you. We are adjourned.